Okay, we might get started back now after the break. So everyone's more awake. Yes. Great. So we were looking at the double slit experiment, and they really did this experiment with electrons. And we saw the kind of pattern you might expect, the two vertical lines. We had sort of a naive idea that electrons are just light, tiny scale down particles, bubbles, specks of dust. But what they actually saw was that they actually saw something like this kind of rows with gaps in the middle. And I think, you know, show this to most people, it's very, very surprising. If you plot kind of the probability to find the electron at various points, then you see this pattern here, the sort of central maximum, minimum, then another maximum, then a maximum, then a maximum there. And if you look just the general qualitatively at it, you look at side by side next to the pattern, you see double slit interference. There was sort of a couple of slides back here. It's exactly the same. So qualitatively, all the basic features are identical. You cannot distinguish between the two. And so what that is very suggestive of is that electrons do have a wavelength aspect, as you know. And if you actually saw, but the one interesting thing is that actually saw the electrons, as I said, at particular points, and so they built up this pattern slowly over time. And so they actually have a very cool movie. So we'll show that now. But if you actually go to the site there, they have this movie actually showing kind of simulation of the experiment. So we'll run this.
So the double video experiment.
And what's the probability of that happening?
Okay, so we'll do it. We'll do it properly this time. Okay, so here we go.
Now we are looking at the detector plane in the monitor. Bright spots appear here and there. These spots indicate individual electrons. Electrons are somehow non-locating. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron in the microscope is very small. Not to mention the chance of finding two. And since electrons are detected one by one as particles, we have to conclude that each electron must have passed through at random on either side of the particle zone, thus creating a uniform distribution without any interference when accumulated. Under such conditions, do electrons form a uniform distribution? But look, we begin to see some fringes in the perpendicular direction that looks like interference fringes. Since this experiment lasted for more than 30 minutes, I have spent the movie out. Interference fringes are now clearly visible.
So that's what they saw. Of the many, you know, thousands of electrons.
Right? So that's the...
So what happens? So we see a clear breakdown of particle model of electrons. And one interesting thing, just to really to bring this out, just how strange and counterintuitive this is, given that you have a particle model of electrons. And it's a very natural, so it's kind of, it is strange, and this is a strange quantum thing we'll go into a bit further. So electrons, you do see this interference pattern, but again, you see them being measured at, you find them actually at particular points. So it's not like a complete wave pattern. And so if we assume that you just have one slit open and you shoot 1,000 electrons towards wall A, what you might find is you might just pick some sort of little narrow region here, C. So it sort of corresponds to here. So it's not sort of not quite correspond to any of the maxima, the interference maxima. But you might find shoot 1,000 electrons, and just within this window C, you might find that we just detect 100 electrons. We have slit one open. And then, you know, change open slit 2, close slit 1. We might detect 400 electrons out of every 1,000 we put through in that small window. So slit 2 is a little bit closer to the region C, so more electrons makes sense. So given we open both slits, we'll fire 2,000 electrons at wall A. And so in a sense, we're just sort of adding on the two experiments, adding them together, exactly what we had before. And so if you have the particle model, you think that what you do is you just add you just add the two numbers of electrons together. That, you know, we had one possibility, 1,000 electrons, so we have 400. And then 1,100, add 400 plus 100, we get 500. So we should actually have 500 electrons, the answer there. But in this, sorry?
Well, but no, because if you have two separate experiments,
right,
in the walls blocked, so you're also going to pick up, you've got an extra hole, so the ones that would have hit the wall from the one experiment are now going to actually make it through, right? So it should be more than 500, shouldn't it? Or might
it? Well, it depends on the details. So maybe if you assume that you direct from, I mean, if you make the assumption direct from such that they always go through the slits, okay, and so forth. But yeah, you're right. Okay. We're neglecting ones that bounce back to keep that factor under control. Yep.
Okay, I don't know how this works, but has the electrons hit the screen before the next one is sent? Or is
yes.
Any, okay, so it's completely finished before the next one is
sent? Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll talk a bit about that more in a minute. But that is actually an interesting point that they actually got. So it's like realistically an experiment's a little bit messy, so it's a probabilistic thing, but most of the time that happened. Most of the time there was just really like sending one electron through, waiting for a while, sending another one through, but there was a very, very small chance of only two electrons going through. And that was a big point, and they wanted to do that because you still see the interference pattern there. So it's as if one way of explaining it is if every single electron is interfering with itself and causing that interference pattern over time.
Right, but it's interfering differently if there's two slits than if there's one slit.
Yes, yeah.
It interferes with itself knowing how many slits there are. Yeah. If you open it one way on the very end, does it know?
It does. Somehow it knows. It's very, yeah. So this is a strange, weird quantum thing. And so Hans Westman, one of our researchers here, will be talking about that, touching on this kind of this afternoon. But yeah, I mean, how does the electron know? You could have, you could decide the last minute to open or close one slit. If the electron went through the other slit, how does it know?
But if you separate the slits too far, it won't work. They've got to be close together.
Oh, well, I mean, it depends on the details. So if you do separate them, that would diminish the effect. But if you make them, you know, kilometers apart or something like that, unless you have some weird source, then yeah, you will. So in practice, yes, absolutely, yeah.
Amy, I don't remember the result, but didn't they have a way of, after one of them had passed through either one of the slits, that they closed off the slit? And then it changed the pattern again. So after having passed through the slit, but before it hits the screen, that they closed one of the slits.
No, I don't think they did that. I mean, there are some obscure things called quantum erasure, and what they effectively, one experiment they did was they actually did this where I'll talk about this in a minute, but they had detectors here basically watching to see cameras to see whether each electron went through this slit or through that slit. And when they actually, if you do that, then you actually know which slit it goes through, so you lose the interference pattern. But what they're able to do in one experiment, I don't think it was with electrons, more with photons, but actually see, do that. But while the electrons were going from this wall to the final wall, they could actually somehow erase that information, so forget about the fact that they know which slit the particle or the photon went through, and then they get the interference pattern back, which is very strange. Mm-hmm. But it's something like that.
All right, so if you know which slit it went through, then it becomes like a single slit interference pattern? Is that what you were saying?
A single slit pattern, yeah, sure. Or just two of them added together, yeah. So it's kind of like, so if you know which one way of thinking about it, if you know which slit it went through, then you know that sort of just, in a sense, destroys the wave-like properties. It's not acting like a wave anymore. So, but it's, yeah, very counterintuitive. So the 500 there in the hypothetical experiment we're talking about, assuming all the electrons do go through at least one of the slits. But what you can actually get, you can think of many examples and scenarios where you could get actually a lot less than 500. So,
Or more.
So, and you can actually have cases where you can have a certain number of electrons go, so you can have slit one open, slit two open, and say have 400 electrons being registered of every 1,000, certain rate. You can actually open up slit one, and then you can actually decrease the number or the rate in which you're actually detecting electrons in this region. And so, from a particle point of view, this is very, very strange. You can actually open up double the number of waves. You can have the electrons go through and reach this region C here. So surely, if any, that cannot harm or decrease the number or the rate of electrons you're measuring this interval here. But you can actually find that happening in quantum physics. So again, if you have this particle mentality that's just in your head, very difficult to explain. But then if you think it's very resonant, and what you actually are getting is destructive interference between the two possibilities. So it's exactly like in general respects, it's exactly like what you get with two water waves. You get two water waves in the double slit experiment. At certain points, you get the interference minimum. They're destructively interfering with each other, and so you get cancellation. And here, the same thing, except instead of a water wave, it's like a probability wave for the electron. And that's split up into two possibilities, and they destructively interfere with each other, and that actually decreases the number of electrons you're getting at that particular point. And so in general, what you can have, so this could be, as Dave said, this could be a greater than sign. So you can actually have the probability of finding electrons at a particular point. X could be anywhere along the horizontal line where you have all the detectors lined up. And the probability there with slits 1 and 2 open can actually be less than, say, 100 plus 400, or in general, less than the probability of finding an electron when you have one slit open, plus the probability of finding an electron when you have another slit open there. So normally, the standard thing is if you're two ways something can happen, what you do is, and there's a certain chance of it happening by one way and a certain chance of happening by another way, you just add up the probability, sort of a quarter plus a half or whatever the probability is. I guess in this case it would be 1/10, 100 over 1,000, and then 4 over 10, 400 over 1,000. So you don't actually do that, so that rule doesn't work. And so how do you actually calculate the right probability? What do you do in quantum physics? And to actually calculate the probability, with both slits open, that you'll find a wave or an electron at one particular point X along the screen, what you do is you actually do exactly the same thing that you do for ordinary water waves. It's the same thing. You find the two amplitudes that contribute to the probability at that point, sort of add the two amplitudes together, constructively or destructively, and then find the magnitude of the resulting sum, and then square this, and that gives you your intensity in the case of water waves. But in this case, it's a probability intensity, if you like. And so what we have, the probability for one and two open, that's given by the sort of the amplitude here. We have kind of the modulus there, so technically it could be a complex number, but that's not really important. We actually kind of square this electron amplitude here. And so what actually is this total electron amplitude there? Well, it's made up by either two components, just example by the kind of the probability wave or the amplitude for an electron going through the first slit. And the probability amplitude of it going through the second slit. And so just as with water waves, we need to add up the two probability amplitudes there for the two possibilities. and take their magnitude and then square them, and that's the result. That's the way we do things. And okay, so that's kind of general. Yes.
I have a question. Yeah, I mean, if we do the experiment with light, we use just one source of light in order to get coherence.
Yes.
If you don't have coherent light, you lose the pattern. Now, could this particle experiment be done with two machines that throw?
What do you mean? The
with two sources instead of one.
Oh, you couldn't do it. What you do, you actually do have one source. I mean, there's one source, you have one electron gun that's firing them out. I mean, you could have two sources if. So if you had them in synchronized with each other, you would. But you would still see the pattern because this is just one electron at a time, so the coherence doesn't matter. Yeah, but if you only have, you could do this, you could have an electron gun that fires out one electron, you could have that go through, then you could wait for an hour, you could wait for a day, and then do another one, and then have that go out, and then do another one,
It takes just longer.
Yeah, and then if you do that, you still will build up the pattern, so then you don't have to have any particular coherence relationship between the electrons. You could actually do that. So in theory, that would be a way you could do it with two electron guns. Yeah. Okay. So this is what we have. The total pattern there. And so we have, and sometimes the example is what we can actually have when you have destructive interference. You can have the sum of the two components here, taking their modulus or the magnitude and squaring that. That actually be less than if we just kind of square the component or the amplitude, the probability amplitude coming from the first slit, plus squaring the probability, adding that to the square of the probability amplitude coming from the second slit there. And so just an example of what we were talking about before. So let's look at a concrete example. If we had at some particular point the amplitude, the sort of probability amplitude of the electron, coming from the first slit, could be 1/5 at a particular point along the screen, and the probability amplitude of the electron going through the second slit being -1/4, -1/4. Then if we calculate this left-hand side here, what we do is we 1/5 and then -1/4, and then square that. So that gives us 1/20, and square 1/20 gives us 1/400. And so what we actually have there, the minus sign, basically that is destructive interference. Essentially, they're out of phase with each other by pi 180 degrees. And so it's exactly what you have when you get close to an interference minimum in the double slit interference experiment. Exactly the same type of thing happening mathematically. And if you compare that to 1/4 squared + 1/5 squared, that's 41/400, which obviously is a lot greater than 1/400. And so this is one concrete example where we have the destructive interference. We actually have the two possibilities of the electrons going through two different slits, actually causing a decrease in the probability of finding the electron coming at one point. And as we talked about before, it doesn't have to be destructive interference, it can be constructive, so this can actually be a greater sign there. So what really we are seeing is just a tangible, particular example, another way in which electrons can actually behave like waves, like water waves. And we see this interference phenomenon.
David,
yep.
What does a negative probability mean?
What does a negative probability mean? Really, it's just out of phase. So it's just a phase relationship. So really, it's just out of phase with probability one. So you can also think about that. If you think of the probability, the wave function psi of its probability amplitude being a field, at every point in space. It just means that at every point in space, or at that particular point, you kind of, it's like a trough. You can think of it as being like that. If you think of a crest as being zero phase, and a trough is if you think of a crest as being positive, then you think of a trough as being negative. That's sort of a negative height for the wave, the probability wave. So the general rule we have in quantum theory is if there are so we have the electron and some particular point there, well, it could go through the slit here and get to that point, or well, it could go through that slit. So there are two ways you can actually have the electron, two possibilities for getting to point C or any point X there along the wall. And so what you do, the sort of general rule in quantum theory, if there are two or more ways of detecting a particle, an electron or whatever it is, at some particular point, and there's actually no way to distinguish between those two ways. There's actually, it's impossible to tell, you know, the electron doesn't have a little sign or tag on it saying, I went through slit one or I went through slit two. What you have to actually do, the general rule is, you have to add up the amplitudes for those two ways, and then you take the modulus of that sum, and then you square that, so essentially squaring the sum, and then actually gives you the probability for that particular event happening, for that thing happening, for finding the electron at one particular point. And it doesn't, it's not just actually limited to two possibilities. You could actually drill another hole in the wall or any number we'd like, with three slit experiment, four slit experiment, n slit experiment, and you would actually, basically the same rule still would apply. You would actually have to add up all the different amplitudes for the possibilities of going through different slits, and then essentially taking the magnitude of those and then squaring those. So that's one general principle you find in quantum physics is very much related to as an analogy and directly comes from exactly what we would do with water waves or any other type of ordinary waves. But again, a general principle in quantum physics. Okay, so I have time for another activity now. So just to give you an example of this, to get you looking at this. So this will, won't do this up on the whiteboard, but just do this amongst yourselves. Find a couple of people. So if we, look at one particular point Y, so just some point along the x-axis, it could be sort of anywhere. And we have the wave amplitude, or the probability amplitude for electron going through one slit and coming to point Y being 1/10. And the probability amplitude for the electron going through the second slit, getting to point Y, is 1/5. So given that, what's the probability of finding an electron at point Y when just one slit is open? And so what we need to do is basically take the probability amplitude, then essentially in this case just square that to get the value. So if you could do that, and then talk to people around you and see. And if you've done that, you can go through all the other cases.
I'm going to
So I guess just to run through the answers there, we have, so we just square that. The first one, square 1 over 10, gives us 1 over 100. Slit 2, square 1 over 5, gives us 4 over 100. If both slits are open, 1 tenth plus 1 fifth. And then square that, so it gives us 3 over 10. Then square that, gives us 9 over 100. For here, the left-hand side, and then the right-hand side, we have, I think, square that. So it was 1 over 100 plus 4 over 100. So if you want to find the right-hand side, if we add those together, 1 over 100 plus 4 over 100, gives you 5 over 100. And that's obviously less than 9 over 100. So in this case, this actually is not true. So what we have is, it's actually constructive interference. So we actually have, in a sense, it's the whole is greater than the sum of two parts. So this is an example, and you actually have to have some constructive interference and some destructive interference. And you actually, so this case is not true, but again, it's just another example, really following on with another wave-like phenomena. Okay. So, moving on, what we find is that...
I have a question to ask.
Yep.
If you go back to that and find the average probability of the whole range,
yep.
What did we get?
Like the average
first time you did the structure,
right.
Which was true.
Yeah.
Now you did constructive, which
right.
is false. So now if I take a look at the probability over the whole region, right, for the average probability, because you have a point where it's zero and non-zero value,
Right.
For single and, well, I wouldn't say for single or double, but.
Right.
I mean, if part of it's true and part of it's false, then can you kind of generalize over the whole region and say, what is the average probability by summing up the area in each little piece or whatever you're doing?
Yeah, you do. So you'll get the same answer that average out, and they have to, because you have to find the electron somewhere. So the sum of all the probabilities is always one. And so if you actually add, you know, if you actually add them up, they end up, in a sense, equaling each other out. So, yep. That is, yep, that's a good point. That is very true. Because if they add up less than one, it'd be like you've somehow lost some electrons. She can't do. So we've been looking at electrons, but it's not just electrons that exhibit wave-like properties. According to quantum physics, it's every object, so including you, including cars, have a wavelength. The de Broglie wavelength have wavelength properties, but it's just the point in general, the more massive the particle is, the smaller the wavelength is, the tinier it is. So if you figure out the wavelength for even a tennis ball or anything, even a grain of sand, anything of any reasonable size, it's just phenomenally tiny, much, much tinier, smaller than we could ever see just with the finest, most detailed experiments that we have. But in principle, quantum physics says, there's something called quantum tunneling, where due to the wavelength properties, you can get a solid object, a fundamental particle, you can get from a solid barrier that normally, classically, they just could not get through because they don't have enough energy, kinetic energy to get through, but they can actually tunnel through with some chance in quantum physics. And so basically because we have wave-like properties, because, say, walls are solid barriers that we normally can't get through, quantum physics says that there's minute, tiny probability. If you keep walking into a solid wall, you actually just pass through. But people have done the calculations. You actually figure out how often you have to do it. It's something like a million times for every second that the universe has been in existence. And then you have a 50-50 chance of getting through. So that's maybe an exercise I'll leave you to do later on. But in theory, so you know, if you believe quantum physics, then it's a possibility. Just incredibly unlikely. So recently people have actually been trying to look at bigger and larger objects and see wave-like patterns and behavior for them. So in 2001, people actually observed diffraction patterns for what are called fullerene molecules or buckyballs. And what they are is just 60 carbon atoms bonded together in a configuration, that looks like a soccer ball here, like this, sort of this circular configuration. And essentially they did the single slit experiment, the vertical slit, and they saw a diffraction pattern. And they had narrow slits around about 50 nanometers. And the wavelength, if you actually figure out the de Broglie wavelength for the velocity that the buckyballs were going on, it was quite small, it was about the order of 10 to the minus 12 meters, so very, very tiny. It's actually interestingly much smaller than the slits. And the mass, if you actually figure out the mass of those, it's over a million times more massive than an electron. So very small wavelengths. And here the velocity actually ran about, again, they had just some sort of oven, they heated them up, and they're going about 210 meters per second. And so in that configuration, you can see diffraction, the diffraction fringes, and actually were able to see that in that experiment. And so if you go to, so that's a photo of the picture of the experiment there. If you look down there, that's the source, essentially some oven. You have some source of these carbon molecules, you just heat them up, and then they're just flying all around. You have a little hole in the oven. And so they're just buzzing all around the oven. And some fraction of them will actually basically go out the little hole, and then they'll go towards this rest of the experiment. And you have a collimator, which is just really a long line or corral, just to make sure that the buckyballs are headed in the right direction, not one going off to the side or to the right. So they actually basically sort of narrow them down. So they actually get kind of small band of buckyballs going there. And then here they have the very, very narrow diffraction grating and then the detectors here. But this experiment, there's always this sort of divide between theoreticians and experimentalists. And we kind of, so we're an Institute for Theoretical Physicists. And so when a theoretical physicist draws a diagram of the experiment, it looks something like that. But when you go to the actual experiment, so this was something that, I mean, these experiments take a long time. You just see the complexity of the experiments when you go to the Institute for Quantum Computing tomorrow. But this is something that probably took them about 6 to 9 months to do. There's a whole team of people working on it. It's very, very complicated, very intricate. But there's more information you can find at that site there. So if we look at the world record for wave behavior of mass of particles, it's the same group of people, some scientists at the University of Vienna in Austria, and it's a molecule called fluorinated fullerene. It's similar, but that's actually more than 1.5 times more massive than electrons. So still in terms of ordinary weight, you know, an everyday scale, it's tiny, but that's as large as we've got. Again, smaller wavelength, harder you to find a more detailed experiment. And the same scientists are actually trying to observe the wave nature of a virus. And a virus is of the order of roughly about a tenth of a micrometer, so around about 10 to minus 7 meters in size. And so they're actually, and viruses in some sense are aligned. It's actually something trying to see diffraction, wave-like behavior interference with living creatures. And so the question is, are there actually any fundamental limits? So again, this or no. And so, in theory, you know, you can see the wave nature of a mouse or a cat or a grade 12 physics student in principle. So they're doing some very excellent, very interesting research there. And there's some more details. Okay. So what I'd like to move on to now is, so that's the double slit experiment. Yes?
Question, you mentioned that it was interesting in that previous one how the wavelength was much smaller than the slit length.
Yeah.
So do you have any comments in general about the relationship of the slit width and the wavelength in order to get the best kind of results in these experiments? I wasn't surprised that the wavelength
was smaller. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you read some textbooks, and I've read some textbooks that say the slit width has to be the order of the wavelength. And it can't be greater in order to see the diffraction pattern. But that's not true. I mean, the details, I mean, the diffraction is actually quite complicated. You can be looking at you could be thinking about diffraction that's kind of not too far away from the slit, sort of near field diffraction or Fresnel diffraction if you want to get technical. Or you can look at diffractions of a long, long way away, which is sort of far field diffraction. And basically, the three main variables are that, the wavelength, the slit width, plus the distance from there to there. And just by changing those around, you can get a different kind of diffraction pattern. It just might mean that I think they probably had to have this real world just quite a long way away to actually see the diffraction happening. Because it wouldn't have been very much, but over time, the further you go away, just the more it builds up and builds up. But it's sort of, so it's this kind of this, it's basically interplay of all these three factors. But normally it's not too difficult to actually have basically a wall that's a fair distance away. So it really depends on the interplay of the three factors.
I guess I'm a little confused now because I was under the impression that the single slit experiment was about diffraction.
Yeah.
And the double slit experiment was about constructive and destructive interference.
Yes.
And the wave-like properties are more the latter than the former. So why aren't we talking about them doing double slit experiments with these massive elements?
Oh, okay. So because diffraction is a wave-like property. You don't get diffraction with tennis balls. You don't get this bending around effect with tennis balls as they go through barriers. And so it's a more subtle wave-like phenomena, but it's still a wave-like one.
So you don't need a double-slit experiment in order to demonstrate wave-like phenomena?
No. You could say it's more sort of obvious and it's more sort of staring in your face, but no, you don't. So getting on to key features, we looked at the double slit experiment. What lessons can we pull out of that? And what can we distill quantum mechanics down to? If we want to sort down to four phrases that we could write on a t-shirt and then, you know, wear around every day, what would we do? So one, arguably the wave particle duality, and you know about this. And so a particle is something that always acts like a particle, 24/7, 100% of the time, every single experiment. A wave is something that always acts like a wave, every single test you do, every single experiment is set up, it always acts like a wave. So these electrons that we have sometimes act like particles. We've seen that by measuring them at localized particular points. Sometimes they act like waves. We see interference patterns, diffraction patterns. They're wave phenomena. So it's like an electron that, in a sense, schizophrenic. They have sort of a bit of particle, a bit of wave. And so the way Richard Feynman put it, physicist who won the Nobel Prize in 1965, was he says it's like neither. So you can read the quote there. Historically, the electron, for example, was thought to behave like a particle, and then it was found in many respects it behaved like a wave. So it really behaves like neither. Now we have given up. We say it's like neither. Because it's neither consistently all the time a wave, nor it's consistently all the time a particle. So it's some other thing. So the electrons are simply electrons. And maybe we might need to have a new category, wavicles or whatever, to decide what they're actually like. But the interesting thing, even though neither picture is complete, they actually have some element of truth in them, truth to them. And so electrons have the one hand a bit of particle in them, and the other hand a bit of wave in them. So they have this dual nature, this sort of two sides or two facets to them. And it's kind of interesting that by themselves, these traditional pictures that we're familiar with have had for hundreds of years in physics, neither of them by themselves are sufficient on the quantum level. Neither of them work completely. But if you kind of like two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, sort of put them and add them together, then they are actually sufficient in any experimental setup, at least for what we're considering here. So just with the particle pictures and just with the wave pictures, you can actually build up and model and predict the results of all the experiments you could do with the double slit experiment and many, many experiments in quantum physics. So it's kind of this sort of piecemeal solution. It's like if you need to know the experimental setup, and for some of them, which particular experiment you're doing, which particular aspect you're looking at. And sometimes we're looking at, say, the double slit experiment with electrons. You need the to look at the wave theory or the wave-like kind of picture. Other times it's the particle-like picture. But added together, they come with a complete picture. So that's the wave-particle duality. And again, this is not something you just get for electrons. They've done diffraction interference experiments with neutrons. You get the same thing. With light as well, it's another common thing, light as a wave and particle-like aspect. All quantum particles do. Just in different experiments, these different aspects manifest themselves. And so you get this, these quantum animals, these quantum things and entities, really kind of cut across these traditional concepts that physicists have used for years and years. And that makes sense. Just because Isaac Newton, Galileo, and physicists for hundreds of years found to describe things on the everyday scale, these two ideas or theoretical concepts that we humans have created in our minds of the wave and the particle, why should they necessarily be good and useful when we're looking at things at the quantum level at the atom, which is about a million times smaller than a grain of sand? And so one thing this is saying, the wave particle duality is saying, is we have to expand our mind and look at new concepts and new ideas. So this is one thing, core concept. So another thing, arguably the most important thing, and I've talked to some professional physicists, you know, and if you get them drunk and you say, okay, what is quantum, the core defining one feature of quantum physics, if you have to, you know, boil it down to one thing, and some would say arguably superposition is or quantum superposition is one key most important thing about quantum physics that really defines it. And so we looked at the double slit experiment with electrons. And as I mentioned before, it's been done with just one electron passing through each slit or the wall at one time. And so again, you saw after thousands of electrons, you build up the interference pattern. So this suggests that actually at the level of individual electrons, we get this superposition that's happening, that we can associate with an individual electron. It's very suggestive of this anyway, this kind of probability wave. And we have this probability, wave for an individual electron going through slit one and through slit two at the same time, which is suggestive of each individual electron actually also going through this slit and that slit, and then kind of recombining on the other side. And just like a water wave interfering with itself, and that leads to the interference pattern. Because if we didn't have something like that, something happening at the level of an individual, each single electron, then how could over time we build up the interference pattern that we saw in the video a little while ago? And so again, everyday objects. Common sense tells us that if we have baseballs, cars, trees, and so forth, they're always constrained to just exist in one place at one time. You know, we don't see superposition on the macroscopic scale. But if we look at an individual quantum entities such as electrons, photons, and atoms, anything, then, however, what it's very suggestive of, they can actually exist in fuzzy states of affairs, which you might call superposition states, in which it seems the multiple possibilities are realized simultaneously. And an example of that, we saw the double slit experiment. If we look at the wave function of this probability wave for the electrons, we have this not just going through one slit or through another slit, but actually going through this superposition, exactly like a classical wave, a water wave superposition of going through one slit and going through the second slit. So, yes?
What happened to the hypothesis that they considered that an electron might be coming from another dimension to interfere with the first electron that went through?
Okay. So you've heard about that as a theory that scientists have... Okay. So that sounds like it might be related to many worlds interpretation. And so in that, that's the idea that when... So Hans Westman, you're talking more about that, but there's one interpretation of quantum mechanics that actually says when you get down to the quantum level, and at least one account of it is that every time a single electron has to actually make a choice and decide whether to go through one slit or another slit at the microscopic level, a teeny tiny electron, what happens is the entire universe, everything you, me, everything splits into two. And in one of those universes, what happens is the electron goes through one slit, takes one row, and the other goes through the other thing. So the entire universe splits just because of this one little electron. And in that interpretation, what happens is so you get these two parallel universes. And then at the final wall, what happens is actually recombine. You actually get two entire universes. This is true. This is, people that paid to do physics kind of believe in this. You actually get the two universes combining. And so in that sense, you get extra dimensions. What's the status of that? Something that some scientists believe in, some don't. Do we have any direct experimental evidence for it? No. So it correctly predicts all the experimental results, but so do a number of other theories, and Hans will be talking about that. So it's still out there. So this is the idea of talking about the sort of electron being in the superposition state. So going through one slit and through the other, mathematically representing that by this superposition of one possibility plus another possibility. And again, Hans will be talking more about this. And a number of alternate views are actually what is happening in the double slit experiment. And one interesting thing, this is actually related to quantum computing. And so we have this new kind of whole breed or species of, if you like, 21st century quantum computers that actually are harnessing some of these weird, strange properties in quantum physics. And in theory, they work out perfectly and are just far more powerful than even the most powerful supercomputer we have around today. In actual practice, we're just at the level of building very, very primitive prototypes. And that prototype at the University of Waterloo that you'll get to see and have a tour of tomorrow afternoon. But if you look at the computer you have on your desk that you might have at home, generally speaking, they just do one computation at once. They're just always doing one thing at once. There's no inbuilt parallelism. But with a quantum computer, you can actually have it not just computing one thing, but just as you can have an electron going through one slit and through another slit, you can have a superposition of possibilities. You can have a quantum computer which is actually in a superposition, or this multiple possibilities, or this fuzzy state where it's doing one computation and it's doing another one and it's doing another one. And you're actually getting it, in theory anyway at least, so it's actually performing millions of computations at once. It has this kind of this intrinsic parallelism. And so you can see how possibly this inbuilt multitasking might be very, very useful and very, very powerful. And that's actually a key reason why quantum computers, in theory, are far more powerful than any kind of standard model we have. It's a whole new paradigm for computing. So that's just a little aside. Then I'll talk more about quantum computers tomorrow. And so superposition, a core defining feature, maybe the defining feature of quantum physics, and underlies many of the counterintuitive phenomena of electrons, for example, appearing to go through both at the same time, and also the final interference electron path that you get. Now, it's not just limited to electrons. You could do the same experiment with double slit experiment with light, with photons, and again, you get superposition there, the same thing. And there are many, many other quantum phenomena. So I talked about quantum tunneling through solid barriers. That also involves superposition, because you get electrons can be actually in a superposition of both having tunneled through the barrier and not having gotten through. So it's through there. There's something even more strange I'll talk about tomorrow, which is entanglement, which is perhaps the weirdest thing in quantum physics. And again, underlying that, if you look at that, you get superposition, get fuzzy states of one possibility and another possibility simultaneously being realized. And just generally quantum interference. I mean, every way you see a strange quantum effect, pretty much you'll find superposition there. So it's this generic thing just running throughout the whole theory. And so it's a very core feature. One interesting fact, it's both weird and not weird, because superposition isn't exclusively found in quantum physics. You can find superposition ordinary water waves, you get it, the double slit experiment. So it's not, you get sound waves, electromagnetic waves, so it's not just limited to quantum theory, but having said that, it is a defining trait of quantum theory, it's very important to the theory. And also, if you kind of look closely at this quantum superposition you have in quantum physics, and you compare it to the superposition you get with wave particles, or waves in ordinary water waves, there actually are some differences. I don't want to get too much into the detail, but if you look at some of the strangest things in quantum physics, such as entanglement, Bell inequality violations, and we'll be talking about those more tomorrow, you actually don't have analogies, or wave analogies just don't exist, and there's no ordinary, everyday, classical common sense analogies for them, as we'll see. And the thing is, again, these electrons, they're spread out like waves when we're not looking at them, but they're always measured at one point. So in the double slit experiment, it's as if electrons and other quantum entities are acting like waves when we're not looking at them, when they're just going between one wall and the other one. As soon as we try and take a peek at them, they actually kind of collapse down to being localized particles. I mean, we don't see the spread out waves. We don't see it directly see the probability waves. You only see an electron being, I mean, in Itachi in Japan, when they did the experiment there, we saw the original basically little localized dots on the screen. You saw the video with little white dots. That's all they saw. You don't directly see the probability waves. And so what we say is, one way of thinking about it is that the probability waves, as soon as we measure them, they're just so sensitive and fragile, they collapse. And so technically people talk about this as the collapse of the wave function. That you always, when you look at a quantum entity, you always collapse the wave function or the probability wave of it, and you only see it at one particular point. And so if we really want to get super technical, then the classical waves actually exist as objects in three-dimensional space, ordinary x, y, z. But the waves you actually get in quantum physics, or the wave functions, they actually exist in this more sort of esoteric mathematical space. And if you have two particles, so you have an electron and a proton, hydrogen, or a neutron as well, a hydrogen atom, then you have three particles, and then the wave function for that actually exists in nine-dimensional space. And if you have n particles, then the kind of the quantum wave or the probability wave actually exists in three times n dimensions. So just kind of a slightly different mathematical object. So that's just one technical point. So just as a mental break. But often, I guess, showing that the reality can be different from perception in many cases, including physics. Okay. So, going with the next picture, genuine randomness. So again, this is very, very important. So what we could imagine, let's do the double slit experiment, but let's just slightly change it. So let's change it so what we have is right next to each slit, one and two, we have cameras or some sort of detector, some devices that just look and see which slit each electron goes through and register which slit they go through and register that and just let the electron pass on and go to the wall. So that's all we're doing. The electron still reads the wall and we have these detectors there. What you might assume is that, we'll still see the trademark interference pattern we saw before. All we're doing is just by taking a note and recording which slit each electron goes through. But it turns out if you do that, in any way you do that, any way, any measuring system that actually tells you which slit each electron goes through, first slit or the second slit, will necessarily actually, in a sense, kill off or disrupt or disturb the interference pattern. And so you always just end up seeing the two, mainly just focusing on the two central humps here. And you're always seeing electrons being distributed like this. So you don't see the light-dark, these sort of interference and sort of multi-stripe pattern. Yes?
The same true for buckyballs? So I can imagine electrons start to detect an electron or disturbing.
Yeah.
Buckyball, you can actually see it,
isn't it? Well, buckyballs are very tiny, so I think they'd be too small. I mean, they're smaller than specks of dust, so they'd be too small to see with the naked eye. So they did similar things with the buckyballs, but it does work with the buckyballs and anything, no matter how big or small it is. Because to actually see the buckyballs, what they did in the experiment, to see them, you actually have to interfere with them. You actually have to bounce light had to reflect off them. And just that very fact of the light reflecting off them is enough to kind of disturb them to actually sort of kill off the interference pattern. So it actually does with buckyballs or anything in principle.
So somehow you can measure without disturbing them. I guess we can't really do that.
Yeah.
No, quantum physics says that you cannot. But it's kind of strange that before quantum physics, the idea of scientists, measuring things that you can be sort of abstract and completely detached from the system, and you can measure nature without disrupting it as this completely passive observer, we actually have to give up that notion in quantum physics. And generally, every time you look at something, you measure something, just because quantum mechanics is so fragile, you necessarily mess them up or disturb them in some way. Okay.
What if you took a picture from the side as it's going in away from you?
So from here?
No, from this side.
This side?
Yeah, so aft pass or something.
So you're looking at taking a picture, so the electrons are going somewhere here, you're taking a picture?
Yeah.
Okay, so to take a picture, if you actually get a picture of what's happening with the electrons, you'll actually have to have some photons will actually reflect off the electrons and reflect into the camera for you to get any information about them. And when you
would that not be happening anyhow? Like, or is this done in the dark? This experiment?
I don't think this experiment was done in the dark. Sometimes with the photon experiments, they do need to do them in the dark. I don't think they'd be particularly sensitive about that. It's kind of interesting. It actually depends on the wavelength of the light that you can actually get some light being reflected off, and it's just of a certain wavelength that can be actually not enough for you to tell which slit the electrons went through. So, but anyway, when you gain information. So if you had a camera here and it was sensitive enough that it could tell you which slit the electron went through, then you have to actually bounce photons or whatever of the wavelength that would actually be, in a sense, powerful enough or disruptive enough that they would mess up the interference pattern. Yes?
We're talking about using photons to measure whether the electron went through the slit or not. I have a moving charge, I have a magnetic field. Would that also be considered a way of disturbing or making...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. So you could do... so the electron has an electronic field around, so you could just put a couple of little... You think put a couple of little test charges there to see how actually they move. So
Or so, magnetic field, because a moving charge has a magnetic field, right?
Sure, absolutely, yep.
But I would suspect that would be the same idea as using a photon light.
Yeah, yeah, given that you consider photons as being made up of electromagnetic fields. What you would find is you would find that if you have a magnetic field or whatever, that actually would have some impact and effect. You know, electrons, moving electrons, you know, are impacted, there's force on the magnetic field, and so that would be enough to disrupt it. And so people have actually thought, a lot of people have thought of various different schemes and can you be really clever and so forth to try and find out about it by in very, very subtle ways. And no matter what way you do it, as soon as you find out, and quantum physics tells us fundamentally, you find out which slit the particle went through, that's enough to automatically, basically, sort of disrupt this pattern so you actually never see the interference pattern there. And yes?
Okay, my question is, if you turn the light on it, or you put a magnetic field
yep.
so you can see it, but you don't use that to gain the information, does it change the... I mean, if you just turn the light bulb on, and you don't use it, does the diffraction pattern happen the way it's supposed to, or the interference pattern?
So you mean you...
You don't look at the photograph.
This gets into very deep philosophical issues, but most businesses would say, yeah, that if you have it there, you could have just a computer, and you have a computer there to register whether it goes off or not. You don't need someone to look at it. But then there's this question of, well, if no one looks at it, then how do you really know what you would see?
That's not what I mean exactly.
Yeah.
Someone has to hear what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If the lights are on,
yeah.
But you don't have a camera.
Yeah.
And so you do the experiment, does it come out the way it's expected to come out? So it's not the light that's causing it. If you can shine light on it and
yeah.
it does exactly what it's supposed to, then it's not the light from the camera and the bouncing back and forth that's causing it to change.
Well, it depends on, you mean if you did this experiment in the light, in a room like this, with this amount of light, well, it actually depends on the wavelength of the light that you use. You could do it with some, so I'm not actually, yeah, you can actually have the experiment, you can have some light here, and I think how would it work? So I think generally if you have light of reasonably, I think it's a long wavelength, then that's actually not enough to distinguish between these two slits, which might be separated by a very, very small distance. But if you have light of a sort of shorter wavelength, then...
You'd have to do an X-ray scattering to get that.
Right.
Like when you talk
right.
about it's kind of confusing in a way to say, well, we're going to look at it with light, because normal light, you don't see an electron.
Right, sure, yeah, okay.
So you'd have to scatter X-rays off this, and X-rays carry a lot of energy, so when you have that...
Yeah.
You have a collision.
That's point. Yeah, that's true. So does that make... Yep.
So just my... So what you're saying here is that at this point in time, there's no way to actually figure out what physical thing that it is that stops the wave propagation happening. At this point, it's still at a level of, if we understand which one it goes through, however we understand that, we lose the wave properties.
You can think that the physical, again, people debate this, but a good way of thinking about it is any scheme you can think of, quantum physics tells any scheme you can think of, no matter how fancy it is, when you have a magnetic field, or you have a camera, or you have an X-ray source, looking at probing the two slits there, any scheme that actually tells you it's fine enough to tell you whether it went through this slit or that slit, basically will involve an energy interaction or giving it some momentum or whatever that will necessarily be enough to sort of bump out and knock off the electrons and kind of sort of disrupt them. And so that disrupt them so that they actually don't produce this interference pattern here. Just as, you don't get interference pattern with water waves if you have a very sort of, if you have a very, very windy day, for example, or a very, very choppy surface, that can disrupt and destroy, you know, the nice, neat pristine interference pattern.
So the general feeling here is that we're not dealing with some sort of metaphysical concept here. We're actually, we're trying to find a nuts and bolts reason for saying that just to get things down to the point where we can distinguish, that's interfered enough to screw things up.
Well, absolutely. So it's you can get, you can get a mechanical hands-on idea. That's not some magical thing that it just, this thing, some magically without some physical mechanism happens to cause another one. Although it is interesting, recently, a couple of years ago in Nature, there was a debate about this. And there was actually basically this issue. And again, you could ask Hans Westman about this, but some people were saying you can actually get a scheme, they come with some very, very clever scheme that measured which slit went through, but without disrupting them, disrupting at least, I think, the center of mass motion of the electrons or whatever was going through, but that would still lead to no interference pattern there, because just the very fact of finding the information or knowing what slit went through would destroy that, because of what they call the principle of complementarity, that you always see wave-like behavior or particle-like behavior, but it's always one, it's either or. It's never actually both. So there would be some that would think that, but generally, you know, the view that I favor the most, it's a mechanical thing, it's a nuts and bolts thing. So, but it's in a sense, you could think about it, just the quantum world is incredibly fragile, and it's just very easy to just disrupt or kill off or to wash out, in a sense, this interference pattern, the slightest interaction into it. Yes?
So the answer to your question was that even if we cannot record the information, but we are providing the same flash of the camera, the same light, that we will see that pattern as opposed to wave pattern.
If you have any kind of measuring device or any gadget that records it, even if you don't look at it, no one actually looks at it, the scientists, they're away on holidays, you will actually not see the, you'll see that pattern there. Is that?
What about if it doesn't record it? It just provides the same kind of interference.
So is it, you mean, it's like you've turned the cameras off, so it doesn't record it?
But the flash is still there.
If you can put it into one, where it flashed, but I have a film in my camera, that idea, but now take it to the 21st century with whatever equipment you use for that.
If
it provides that, and my sheet at the back, which I am looking at and for, I don't see interference.
Yeah.
See that.
So it would depend on the details, but I probably would say yes, because in theory, with the flash is actually potentially some kind of interaction with the electrons. And whether the electron, if you have a flash here, that flash will interact with an electron going through this slit or an electron going through that slit. And so that will be, there is actually some electron photon scattering. And so basically, depending on whether the electron goes through this slit or that slit, the flash will scatter in slightly different ways. You know, in practice, it would be just fiendishly difficult to detect. But in theory, you could think of some really fancy experiment that basically could have all these light detectors around here and could look at the pattern of how the light from the flash was scattered and tell, well, that was consistent with the electron going through here or the electron going through there. And so just enough for you to have the potential to be able to find out which slit the electron went through is enough to kill off or wash out the interference pattern. Yes?
I think all these questions are sort of coming from the question is it the exchange of information or is it the interaction? I think what you're saying is the interaction that causes the interference. What do we actually know about?
That's the general typical answer is actually the physical interaction that causes that. Some people talk about things from an information point of view, but it's hard to think about how just the very fact of having information could... So that's one, I think, one useful way to think about it, but it's hard to think that just merely you or me knowing something could somehow cause this physical change, the fact that there's something different in my head. That seems kind of unusual. But... Yeah, but again, people do, I mean, people, there are different views about this. But generally the standard one is, you know, it's a physical type of, it's physical disturbance type of mechanism in this kind of a case. But yeah, but that's a good point. There are two different ways you can actually look at it. Yeah, we might take one more question. Yep.
Has there been any attempts at predicting the effects of the interaction and then seeing that result, besides the fact that we're losing the field?
Yeah.
But let's say, you know, for a certain wavelength should give this result. And
right.
Successfully seeing that, has there been any experiments with that?
So it's experiments to...
To predict how the interaction would affect the pattern.
Oh,
seeing the effect.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And lots of experiments have been done on that. And it's actually interesting. I have the two patterns, the wave pattern and the particle pattern. It's actually not an either-or. That they've done experiments where they actually had got photons, and they've actually got sort of progressively more and more information from them. And as they do that, what they find is basically the fringes in the pattern get worse and worse. So you could have... So no photons, and then you could have a few photons. And then you kind of see this, but it's more sort of less. Maybe this goes right down to zero here, but... So you get less visibility in the fringes. And so this is sort of like an intermediate thing, and eventually, so it's a continuum. And then if you have more and more photons, they give you more and more information about which slit it went through. Eventually, it kind of morphs, if you like, to... and there's a sort of this continuum of patterns in between these two. But it goes, but people have done those experiments, they've sort of looked at exactly what you would predict by quantum physics, and then they've seen those, really a decrease, really kind of a transition from the wave-like to the particle-like properties. But because in a sense, that's saying that it's not just either you know which slit the electron went through or you don't, but it's more like in this extreme case, you know with certainty, but these intermediate cases would be, well, you're probably 70% sure it went through one slit, 30% sure it went through the other slit. And in the extreme case, you know nothing, it's a 50-50 thing, and that's where you get the interference pattern. But yeah, people have done a lot of experiments in this. Yes, and last question. Yep.
Well, this is a notion in quantum encryption, isn't it? The act that by observing, you bias the signal. So
yes.
From point A to B, but someone looked at it between points A and B. Yeah, you've got a disrupted pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep, you're about 4 slides ahead. Yeah. But absolutely, yeah. So what we will just finish up here. Now, so somehow... what we have is the act of measuring the electrons has destroyed the wavelike interference. And this is actually related to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. And what we have is that the actual probability for finding, so when we have this disturbed pattern, we get these probability distributions here to find the electrons at particular points. And how do we calculate, what rule do we use to calculate what these probability distributions will be? Well, we use what might be more sort of intuitive, and that's if we have probability of finding the electron at some point x with one slit open. That's just equal to the wave or probability amplitude for the electron going through slit one, and then take the modulus of that and square that, and then just add to that the probability of the electron, the probability amplitude of the electron going through the other slit, take the modulus of that and square that. So that's just really adding up the probabilities for the two individual possibilities, which is a very particle-like thing, which is perhaps they've got one way something can happen, we've got another way, just add two ways together to get the total probability. And this is actually a general rule in quantum physics, that if there are two or more ways, it could be four or five, any number, of detecting a particle at a certain place, and we can distinguish between these two ways. Because if we have the camera here, we can distinguish whether the electron went through slit two and came to this point, or went through slit one and came to that point. We can tell the ways. Then you just add the two probabilities, or three, or however many the number is, for all these events, happening. And notice that's different to the indistinguishable case, where we just get a particle at point x. We weren't looking to see which slit it went through. There's no way we can tell which slit it went through. We have to add those two possibilities coherently. And so what we have is, so it's interesting, there's actually really, just to reinforce this, there's actually a nice series of lectures by Richard Feynman. And a couple of years ago, it was probably, I think, in the 1970s, he went and wrote a popular book. And it was on quantum electrodynamics. And so this is a true story. So there's no one from New Zealand here, is there? No, good. Okay. But it's a true story. But he wanted to actually test it out and make sure the explanations and levels are right. But he wanted to, you know, do that in some way that wasn't too, you know, too out in the public's eye and opinion and too prominent, because, you know, what if they were bad? That would be bad. So he wanted to find somewhere in the world that was an English-speaking country, but as far away from, you know, the center of civilization as possible. But he, no, this is true. I'm just repeating. But he wanted to find where, you know, they could understand his lecture, but he could test them out in a low-pressure environment. And then he went to New Zealand. So this is actually a video, so the web link's there, of Richard Feynman. So it goes for about 9 minutes, and it will take a break for lunch. But, okay, this is him actually explaining, it's really to do with reflection, but through an object that, a photon that's going down to a solid object, it could get reflected off the front surface or off the rear surface. But he's talking about this probability rule that I talked about, that if you've got two ways of something happening, indistinguishable, you add them distinguishable, sorry, you add the amplitudes, but... Okay, so... Okay.
Right, let's get the volume up.
And so Feynman, just if you has everyone heard of Richard Feynman before? Of course, okay. It's a very, very, very famous physicist, one of the great characters in physics, won a Nobel Prize, crazy guy. Okay, just get this. Well known for doing all sorts of experiments at Williams University, trying to see if jelly would actually melt and solidify if you actually got it very, very cold and stirred at the same time. You can see if sprinklers actually went around in opposite directions, if you said that there's, you know, the sprinklers that turn around and they go around in one way, you would see if you actually operate in reverse, if they would actually spin back around the other way. And so I went to a laboratory where he was.
That deals with a problem nature, and that's quantum electrodynamics. It deals with photons and electrons. Most of the time, we've been talking about photons. What we've discussed is that mainly the main idea of the talk is to give you some ideas of the kind of framework of ideas which theoretical physics needs in order to describe results of experiments. And I think by this time you'll agree, after two lectures, that they're very weird indeed, and quite peculiar and difficult to believe. But I'll just remind you, or review for one more time, a little bit, about what happens with photons. And as we said many times, two kinds of photons. We have the source here, and the photon multiplier, which meant counts of photons. Even if we have only one photon at a time, and if we have a more than one way that we can have. For example, I've been mentioned several times that the light couldn't the photon could imagine but be reflected on two different surfaces. If there's more than one possible way that something can happen, the whole structure works. In any situation where you have experiments looking at something microscopic, which of course you have in the end to look at something macroscopic, that is large, and the photomultiplier amplifies up. When you have a system like that, you can't predict exactly what will happen, but only the chance that the system operates, that you find something happen here. And this probability is always given as the square, or the circle, of a thing called an amplitude. And this amplitude is a kind of absolute square, it's a special kind of it's a square of the length. And the amplitude is nothing but an arrow drawn on a plane. Now when something can happen in more than one way, the amplitude that has happened is considered calculated by adding the amplitude for it happening one way plus the amplitude that it happens the other way, and when you square that, you get the probability. In a problem like this, we have found that the circumstances or the probability for this event might depend upon how far apart you put the plates, and you get reflection from a pair of plates which varies with the thickness in that manner. And so, this, in our particular example, I finally found out that that was 16% and that was 8%. For each surface, there was 4%. Now, if this were a more ordinary thing, like you would expect, an ordinary type of reasoning instead of this esoteric, such microscopic thing, you would expect that the chance to arrive here could be analyzed by saying, of all the ones that come down, some bound from here with a certain probability, and some bound from here with a certain probability, let's say 1/5 bound here, or one, what we say, 1/25. And 1/25 here would be 2/25 of this. What we would do would be to add the probability. We find out that instead of adding probabilities in such logical circumstances, we add amplitude. In other words, we can sit around and talk about it this way, say, there's a certain, it can go either this way or it can go that way, and we just add the amplitude before we split. But that means that the logic that we can say that it really goes either this way or that way is false. You can't really say that in the common language way, or just meant to add the probability. Because if you were to say it can either go this way, some of them come this way, and some of them come that way, you're at a total loss to understand why, when the thickness is just right, there is none of them come at all. Because if some of them come one way and some of them come in the other way, the fact that they can go both ways surely isn't going to make it that they don't come at all. But that's exactly what does happen. And so the idea is to be able to say that it comes either one way or another. It requires that you know what you're talking about. You're not talking about ordinary either one or the other, but either one or the other in the sense of adding amplitude. So it's a crazy game. I still find myself saying, well, it comes either one way or the other. But it is not really true that for a given particle which arrives here, you can say that it either came this way or that way. You will get the idea. As a matter of fact, it's entertaining. The following thing is very interesting. It is possible to put some kind of atoms on the surface here, such that when light bounces off it, they leave some trace that the atom is left in some other state than it was before. So that if it bounced the light from the surface, an atom on that surface would be left in a different state. Likewise, we can put atoms of this kind, it's rather technically difficult with light, but you can do it in many, many other analogous experiments in similar situations. So imagine you can do that to this. And then we could say, let us bounce the light, and then afterwards look at the atoms and see which ones are excited. What you discover is, if you have enough here, that you don't miss it. If you forget the cases where you miss it. That it's either excited here or it is excited there, yes. In other words, it does look like the photon either goes this way or that way. And when you have the atoms here, and you count just those cases in which you can find, see, I'm worried about the cases where you miss it. Forget the cases that you're missing. And take only the cases where either one or the other atom is excited on one or the other sheet.
and it's for the probability of arriving here. You know what you get as a result of the function of sickness? A completely different result. If you have atoms there that can leave a trail as to whether a light was there or not, you get 8% reflection no matter what sickness. In other words, it tricks you. You learn to be clever. You know that if you have no way to tell from which one it comes, if the light after it bounces off, is everything the way it was before, then you get this funny interference effect. If, however, you put something here to see if the light bounced here or here, you can tell it bounced one or the other. It tells you, it leaves the atoms excited. But lo, there's no more interference effect. Why? How do we describe that? It's not hard. It's that we change the problem. The first problem was, given a source here and material here, what is the probability that for the following event, that the photomultiplier goes off and that the system is left exactly as it was before, that nothing has changed in the glass? That's the first. But in the second experiment, we're asking for a different final problem. We're asking a different problem. The problem is, what is the chance, if we have a source here and this layer here, that the photomultiplier goes off and one of these atoms on this layer here, say, is excited? That's a different problem, has a different amplitude. And that has nothing to do with what happens down here. And that amplitude is 4%, or 0.2 rather, squared is 4%. It has some darn angle, I don't understand angle. Squared is 4%, and the probability that it's reflected from the front surface as detected by an atom is 4%. Likewise, if you ask for the following situation, that the photomultiplier should go up and the bottom one should have an atom excited, you get it also 4%. So you see, if we try to test whether or not it's going one way or the other, then the results of the experiment have changed, or another way, we have to ask about a different experiment. The case of interference is this, that if it's such a situation that the rest of the system, the glass, is exactly the same before and after, and there's no way to tell where the light found. Otherwise, if you had some way to tell, you'd ask for a different physical result, have a different amplitude and different result. Which means, these things I point out because as you've gone along, you've probably struggled to find some kind of a simple-minded explanation of these things. But when you see how annoyingly complicated it gets, I mean not complicated, but curious it gets, it gets harder and harder to make a simple model. So we've given up.
Okay, so I
also,
so that was Feynman talking about the idea if you have two possible ways that it happens. There's another way to distinguish between those two ways if you add the amplitudes. And that's the light being reflected up either the front or the back surface. But if you have a long line of atoms, so that's very analogous, it's basically exactly what we're talking about, putting the cameras next to the two slits, then you can tell, you change the problem as he put it, so you're looking at different things. So actually you lose the interference behavior, you just get the constant 8% that he was talking about. So with that, it's quarter past 12. What we might do, so we'll break for lunch now, but if we're back here, at 1 p.m. for the keynote presentation, following from this, looking at the foundations of quantum physics. So lunch is just where you had the coffee break. So you feel free to leave bags or anything in here if you like, but make sure you have your name tags so you can circle it.
You'll be all right.
Okay, so you're using this.